Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Ed Lentz. Ann is away today. There's an old saying, you are what you eat. If that's the case, perhaps we should all feel a little bit of compassion for the people who live on junk food, fast food, or the plasticized foods of megastore America. There was a time, not all that long ago, when most food for most people was local food. 100 years ago, most people lived in rural America, and even the people who lived in cities often farmed their backyards as if they were still living in the country. And that pattern of living on the land for oneself lasted until well into the 20th century. It was a different world. It was a world of the saying, use it up, wear it out, make it do, or do without. All that could last well into our own time. For a time, it seemed that self-reliant dependence on one's own or simply relying on local resources produced by people one knew then might be a thing of the past. But not anymore. Our guests today represent the forefront of a movement to make food a local matter once again. Tracy Ryder founded Edible Communities with her partner, Carol Topalian, in 2004. And as a result of their success with a locally based edible magazine in their hometown in California. Today, Edible Communities is the home base of just really more than 60 community-based magazines across the United States. Tracy Ryder, welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Hi, Ed. Thank you for having me.
According to her own account, Tricia Ryder first read an issue of Edible Manhattan on a subway ride in New York City in 2008, and decided Columbus needed a magazine like this as well. The result was the first issue of Edible Columbus in the spring of 2010. Tricia Wheeler, welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Thanks, Ed.
Tracy, your recent book about edible communities was subtitled A Celebration of Local Foods. Tell us more exactly what that means to you.
Thanks, Ed. A celebration of local foods for us is that people are really starting to know where their food comes from again, just like you said in your introduction, like they did 100 years ago. And our communities where we publish, each magazine is locally owned and operated by people who know about the farmers and fishermen and ranchers in their area, and each and every magazine is full of stories about those people. So this book, Edible, A Celebration of Local Food, is really, it's not just a compilation, because about 75% of the articles in the book are brand new for the book, but they are representative of all the kinds of stories we publish in the local magazines throughout the year.
Okay, how exactly did you get started with all of this?
Well, I actually grew up in upstate New York in a farm family, and it seemed very natural to me to eat and cook and can and grow things in my backyard. So after graduate school and living in California for a while, I ran with Carol a small graphic design firm, and we were publishing a lot of magazines for tourism and agriculture and culinary clients, and we thought, wow, there's another way to think about food, and what if we just look to our local community? And we started the first magazine, Edible Ojai, in a small agricultural town in Southern California in the spring of 2002. So we did that magazine for 2 years and got a lot of national press attention. And we thought, well, you know, we're really on to something. People are, pardon the pun, but they're really hungry for this information right now. And, we started hearing from people literally around the country who said, we really want one of these magazines in our own hometown. And we worked during that spring of 2004 finding a way to let them do that. So as a result, we now have 65 locally based food magazines, and they are in the U.S. and Canada. We even have them in Toronto and Vancouver now. So we feel it was a lot of happy accidents, but definitely the right thing at the right time.
Well, I'm sorry, I gave a miscount on that. You're adding a number of these every year then as we move along.
We are, and no worries about the miscount, because we have to ask ourselves almost every day how many are we up to, because we add about, for the last 6 years, we've literally added almost one a month.
Well, to sort of cut to the basic point of your book and the work that you're doing, why should we care about local food? Even in, we might be interested in it personally, but does it go beyond that?
It really does go beyond that on many, many levels. So obviously it's healthier food, it tastes better, it's fresher. But on a larger scale, it's also food that hasn't been on a truck for 1,500 miles, which is actually the average distance that most food travels to supermarkets from the farms where it's grown on. It's also, it avoids all those food security issues, such as the E. coli scares we hear about from, you know, a spinach patch somewhere where someone has eaten it and become very ill, because we know exactly where the food is grown. It's usually grown organically. It's grown by people we know in our own communities. And then economically, it's a much larger benefit because, you know, for every dollar that's spent in a local community with a local farmer or a local farmer's market, 85 cents on that dollar stays in the local community, which is vastly different than the money we spend at, you know, large, big box and chains. You know, not that they don't serve a purpose, especially in the areas where there's extreme seasonality, but the more and more that we can eat and buy food from local farmers and farmers markets, the better our global warming situation will be, the better the local economies will be, and the better our health will be.
Okay. Tricia, let me just ask you in passing along the way with this.
Sure.
How would you define local food as opposed to not so local food?
As Tracy said, I would define it as what's grown in our own community or produced in our own community, not something that travels by truck to along all those miles to reach our grocery stores. It'd be something where we can have a relationship with the artisans, the farmers, the producers in our own community and know where the food is grown and where it's coming from.
I noticed that Tracy's book cited a book by another fellow called Coming Home to Eat, and he made a whole practice about trying to acquire his food within 250 miles. Let me just ask either Tricia or Tracy, is there any kind of concurrence or definition on what constitutes local food, or is it just that it feels local enough to me to know what I'm getting? I guess that's what I'm really asking along the way. Is there some?
Do you want to start with that, Tracy?
Sure. Well, I think the general, most simple rule of thumb is anything within a day's drive.
Okay.
And because, you know, some people drive faster than others, so
okay.
Instead of giving it a mileage chart. But, you know, and we do need to think, I mean, local, our magazines are actually hyper-local, they're considered, because, like, Edible Columbus, for example, really talks about what is going on with the food in Columbus. But if you look geographically across North America, I think what we're saying is we're really talking about regionality in food. So, you know, anything within your region, and just in the simplest form, if you can drive there within a day, then it's within your food shed in your region. So I like to think of it that way. The other thing I love to tell people about local food, because I think people get really anxious, like, oh, my gosh, what's going to happen, you know, in the winter and there just aren't any tomatoes, and how am I going to eat locally when it's snowing out and things like that. But I think there's a huge movement right now going back to canning and preserving and freezing foods that are, you know, from the harvest in the late summer and early fall. And also, I think that what we've learned is that we could save every family farm in America if we only ate one out of every 10 of our meals locally. So I think for listeners, it's really important to know that, you know, we're not asking for perfection here. We're just trying to encourage ourselves and each other to try for that 1 in 10 meal or, you know, a couple of times a week to eat locally.
When we talk about local food, are we talking about food that's more expensive generally than other sorts of food that one might normally buy?
Well, I think that's a great question, and it always comes up, and there's always some backlash about local food being elite and things that we hear now and then. But what I'd love to tell people is local food is really not only the best tasting and the nutritionally best for you because it's picked at the height of season and it's really ripe. And if you think about it, whenever that occurs, that's when food is at its cheapest. So, you know, in around Labor Day when all the fields are full of corn, you know, corn is very inexpensive at that time. Same thing with everything else that you pick at the peak of ripeness. So, you know, the other side of the coin is many of these farmers are very small and they're hand-making everything they grow or produce. So, yes, sometimes there is a slightly, higher cost, but mostly there's not when things are at the peak of season. So if you think about it, though, you're working with a small family farm who's trying to earn a living and keep that money in the local economy. So if you're buying something from them and it's 10 cents more or 20 cents more and all that money is staying in your community, it's actually giving a larger benefit to the entire area rather than just, you know, that saving that 10 or 15 cents on a head of lettuce, you know, at a supermarket.
Okay. Tricia, let me just ask you another common question that may come up about the local foods movement is how does this relate to the movement, the organic food movement? Are the two movements related?
Sure. Yeah, they are. The way I talk about it within the magazine and with people that are interested in that distinction is that they're both important, and some of the local food is produced with organic methods. But, you know, eating locally, in my opinion, is the first place, and then also looking at the food that's being produced organically. But, you know, you can have both pieces being very important. But if we go with what's grown that we know about in our own community, that's how you start with the local piece.
Tracy, you have any thoughts on that as well?
I absolutely agree with Tricia. I mean, at Edible Communities, we say that over and over again. The other side of the coin is most farmers in your community who are coming to your farmers markets are definitely organic farmers, whether they're certified organic or not. The process to become certified is really complex. It can be time-consuming, and it's somewhat costly, and it's something that's very rigorous and has to be, you know, redone all the time and renewed. So many farmers are not spraying. They're organic farmers, but they just haven't gone through the certification process. So, you know, we like to say that local food is when you know who your farmer is or where your food comes from. So if you have questions about it, just ask them, are you organic? And they'll tell you the truth. Every farmer will tell you the truth. So we definitely think local is much more important than organic.
Okay. At the end of your book on edible communities, you say your goal is to get people to think, act, and eat locally. We've been talking about eating. Let's talk about thinking and acting as well. Is there something specific you have in mind when you're saying that at the end of the book?
Well, I think about, you know, the thinking and acting part is just taking, you know, a few beats before you go through that drive-through window of fast food or go to buy produce at some big box store where they're buying, you know, apples from China or whatever it is. And again, you know, we don't want our readers to feel like they have to feel guilty about their food choices. We don't want them to feel like they have to be activists. This movement is very celebratory and it's very simple. So but the acting and thinking is to really just every chance you can buy something from someone you know who's grown it down the street from you. And it might take a little more time to chop it up, but it's probably going to be less expensive in the long run and better for you. So that's the thinking and acting when we're talking about local foods.
Okay, we're going to take a break for about a minute on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Ed Lentz, and we're going to be back to talk more about local food here in Central Ohio and across the country.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher with guest host Ed Lentz. Developed by WOSU Public Media and the Columbus Metropolitan Library, ColumbusNeighborhoods.org features more than 30 neighborhoods in and around Columbus. It allows users to tell their own stories, post their own photos and video, and contribute to the collaborative story of Columbus. Be a part of this multimedia public engagement project or learn more by visiting ColumbusNeighborhoods.org. It's currently 77 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:20 this morning. A few clouds leaving us sunshine in the afternoon and a high of 85 today. And then clearing skies overnight tonight, a low of 62. Sunshine for Thursday, a high of 82 degrees. Looking ahead to Friday, sunshine and a high of 87. All Sides continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
We're back. This is Ed Lentz, and we're on All Sides with Ann Fisher this morning, and we're talking about the local food movement with Tracy Ryder from Edible Communities and Tricia Wheeler from Edible Columbus. If you have a question or a thought about the local food movement or where to find some good local food or anything else along that line, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Throw us an email at allsides@wosu.org. Tricia, let's talk a little bit for a moment about local chefs and the relationship of local chefs to the local food movement. How do the two sort of come together, one with another?
I think local chefs are at the forefront of the movement. I think they set the tone in the community for their participation, their support of the movement. And we're fortunate in Columbus to have several chefs that are leading the way in our community on this subject matter. And it's been really exciting to be able to tell their stories in a way that really can focus on kind of the sources that they go through to find the food and the distributors and the chain of things that happen for them to bring farm fresh food to the plates of the diners in Columbus. And we have several. In this summer issue of Edible Columbus, we feature Elena from Elena's Restaurant. And it's a really interesting look at what she does daily to put a menu together that evening and how she goes through her sourcing. She's notorious for walking to the North Market and picking out her food that she's going to serve to her customers that evening, and it's all perfect and fresh and wonderful.
Oh, we have a call coming in. Tom, do you have a question or a thought for us today?
Yes, good morning. I'd like to ask your guests about the appearance of food, and I'm going to use here as an example the apple. When you go into a store, you see all these apples, and just absolutely perfect looking. They almost looked artificial. And yet, I suspect to get that perfect look, it requires more spraying, more chemicals to control the insects, whereas an apple that may have a few defects on it may be a better quality, have a better taste. I'd like to hear what they say about that.
Tricia?
Sure. I think you're absolutely right. Our food doesn't come in a perfect package when it's grown right in our backyards and on the farms in our community. Sometimes it's more beautiful, but sometimes those little blemishes or those things are fine. And I think that you touched on the fact that what's coming across on the trucks and being artificially ripened is happening and producing those perfect-looking apples, but they don't have the same taste and the same texture and feel as the things in our own community. Maybe, Tracy, you might want to touch on some of that process also.
Well, a lot of the perfection we see in foods right now, which I think people are still unaware of to a large degree, I certainly was myself, is that those perfect apples and perfect tomatoes are often genetically modified, and it's happening. It's not food companies don't have to put that on the labels, and they don't have to tell you they've done that. So a lot of that food perfection you see is actually, what do they call it? Better food through chemicals. But Trish is absolutely right. I think we've forgotten the character and the sort of the good humor of our food. There are some pretty funny looking apples out there that might have a bug bite in them or something, but they're going to taste a whole lot better when you actually eat them. So you need to take into consideration if it looks too perfect, it probably is.
May I follow up just a little bit?
That's fine.
Tomatoes. In order to say if tomatoes have to be transported a long distance, they will breed tomatoes that have a very tough, hard skin. I'm sure you've all had those. Whereas the tomatoes that are close by can have a more tender, delicate skin and much better flavor. Is that correct?
That's absolutely right, Tom. And there's actually there's a lot of articles on the internet right now about the square tomato, that when the genetic scientists were working on how to transport tomatoes, first of all, they have to pick them before they're ripe, and secondly, they actually have genetically altered them so that they grow more square and squatty than they do round, because that lets them put more on a truck and it lets them ship better. So again, we need to find those beautiful, round, luscious, juicy tomatoes that were grown in a farmer's field not too far from where you live in order to have that great tomato taste.
Very good. I appreciate your show today. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the call, Tom. Okay. Just Tricia, going back to where we were a moment ago, are there any other local chefs you'd like to mention specifically in passing?
I think Latitude 41 is doing a great job that people wouldn't necessarily think a large hotel in the city would have such an interesting restaurant. And it's sourcing. The cheeses on the menu are all from local dairies and cheesemakers, and the they're featuring the farms on the menu where they're sourcing their ingredients from. And I know that their chef there, Dave, is taking a real active role in sourcing throughout Ohio to have wonderful things on his menu. And there's several in our community that are really looking at this, and I think it's going to come. I think people do look up to the chefs in the community and are following their lead. And when they see more on the menus and they're able to taste the things that they create with local food, I think it's better all around.
Tracy, is it fair to say that emphasis on the local chefs is sort of a continuing theme in every one of the edible magazines?
Oh, it absolutely is. From Hawaii to Manhattan to Seattle, chefs are such visible people in our communities, and they are definitely at the forefront of this movement, and they're making, enormous efforts to source as much as they can locally.
Okay. Let's move on and talk a little bit about farmers. What sorts of farmers are getting involved in this movement? Tracy, we can start with you on that one, just generally.
That's a great question, Ed. Actually, in our book, the stories in our book, each of our communities every year, starting in a few weeks and going through the fall, all the readers from all the magazines, such as Edible Columbus, will be able to vote online for their favorite local food heroes from their own community. They nominate them and vote. So, and one of the categories is farmer, and one is chef, and some are nonprofit organizations. But it's interesting because in the book, then, we have stories about all these local heroes who are chefs in the local communities. And what we're seeing more and more, I think right now the statistic nationwide is something like the average age of farmer is 65 years old. Well, that's not good for us, because at some point they're going to want to retire. And if they can't keep their land farmland, or if it starts becoming developed, we're going to continue losing more of these small family farms. So what's happening is, many of the older farmers today are finding ways to lease their land to younger farmers. So what we're seeing is a lot of the farmers are young families, and something like 32% of new farmers today are young women, which is different than we've ever had in our history. So I think there's a new generation. They call it the second back to the land movement, but they're not like the hippies and how we used to be when we went back to the land the first time. These are really well-educated, very bright entrepreneurs who have chosen farming as a profession, and they want to raise their kids in a different environment than the one they're living in. So it's really exciting for us to see young women and men and families starting to farm.
Now, have you formed an opinion after the few years that the magazines have been running? Has this new farming movement become more successful in some parts of the country than others?
It's interesting. Yes, it has become more successful. And it's really not intuitive in terms of which communities do better than others, because, some are closer to large metropolitan areas and some are very rural. A lot of it, unfortunately, still is dependent on weather. So, we have a lot of great young emerging farms in the Midwest, especially in Iowa, that are not big truck farms and agricultural industries. But and then, two summers ago, the state of Iowa was completely flooded. So I think a lot of the success still depends, on the climate and what's going on with the weather, because that is, the ultimate deciding factor, whether a crop succeeds or not.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking this morning with Tracy Ryder and Tricia Wheeler about the local food movement. If you have a question or a thought or a comment about local food, if you're a fan of the local food movement or just want to learn a little bit more about it, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or send us an email at allsides@wosu.org. To stay on that subject of farms for a minute, back with Tricia, do you have some examples or thoughts about folks here in Central Ohio that you've come in contact with as part of this new farming movement?
Sure, yeah. When you talk about bright entrepreneurs that are embracing this movement, a perfect example is Jamie and Adam at Wayward Seed Farm. We featured them in our first edition of Edible Columbus, and they have not only a passion for what they're doing, but they also have the business smarts and acumen that they are going to take what they're doing and make it the best they can. And to Tracy's point, the weather that's affecting them right now. We've had so much rain in Columbus, and so I just got an update from them this week that's affected some of their vegetable crops temporarily. But, even with you know, you can't plan perfectly in this industry, but they've adapted quickly and they have a great business model.
Okay. Tracy, let me just ask in passing, the structure of your Edible Communities, it's essentially a franchise magazine movement. Is that an easy way to summarize it?
Well, I think that's an easy way for most people to understand it, but the truth is we're actually not franchises. We operate under license agreements.
Okay.
And the reason we did that was manyfold, one of which, operating through a license agreement, which basically means Tricia and all of our other publishers have the right to use the name Edible, followed by their location, such as Columbus, and they get a lot of support from us, and they get a brand that is now recognized because we publish 5 million magazines a year. But they, within that, they have a lot of freedom to make the magazine exactly what it needs to be for the Columbus community. It also allows the magazine to be completely owned and operated locally. So, again, we're trying to walk the walk in that, you know, once the fee for the license agreement is paid, the rest of the money stays in the local community. So those advertisers who support our magazines, their money stays in the community, and it stays with Tricia, and she then goes to her local farmer's market and hosts cooking classes and does all things. So it really is something that does give back to the local community. It just doesn't leave and come to us. We have a staff of 4 people and a couple of part-timers. We're actually a very small organization. So it is a license agreement. Each magazine is locally owned and operated in the community they publish in, and they become part of a network where they also get a lot of support from the other publishers who are doing, you know, the same exact thing, yet none of them are competing with one another. So we find it our own sustainable model.
Okay. We have another call coming in. Mark, do you have a question or a thought for us today?
I do. Just earlier ago, one of your guests, I don't remember which, mentioned that more and more of our crops are genetically altered. And I'm just curious as to, is she talking about selective breeding or actually manipulation of genes and implanting genes from other crops or animals?
Okay. I think that's Tracy. Were you talking?
Yes, that's right. Hi, Mark. It's an excellent question. I'm actually talking about it in both ways. It is happening both ways. I mean, obviously, the genetic selection toward better and better, what some people consider better and better, has been going on a very long time. But this is actual, putting a termination gene into something so that you can't collect the seeds and replant it. I mean, there is some actual genetic changing going on as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Uh-huh. Thanks for the call. Tricia, why did you think that Columbus, Ohio was ready for a magazine like Edible Columbus?
You know, I had spent a year in Manhattan studying food and going to the French Culinary Institute, and I'd picked up the first copy of Edible Manhattan while I was there, and I fell in love with it. And I worked hard to bring it back to my community when I returned. And that first weekend I was home, I went to our farmer's market, which I've done for 6-7 years passionately, and I couldn't believe it, just 1 year being away, how much they'd grown and how many people were asking good questions. And I sat out on the sidewalk at the Worthington Inn and just listened and watched and thought, I think this is what I want to do. And I feel like Columbus will embrace this and be ready for it. And I've been so just surprised and happy with the response we've gotten and the support in the community and the support from the advertising base who believe in this and want these stories told.
So then how has the reception been to the first issue of the magazine?
Oh, so nice. I mean, so wonderful. And, you know, we have a great team of food writers involved. We have a great photography team. The Edible Communities have supported us and given us so many great ideas and launched us in a way that I felt very confident that we could be successful. And just the amount of emails of people who have reached out or who have called and said that they really love it and it's something different and it's unique and that they can't wait for the next issue. And then all the subscribers that have come on to support us has just been amazing.
What have you found so far just in the first couple of issues that your readers here in Columbus seem to like best about the magazine?
I think people are coming at it. What's really interesting about the models, you know, we can focus kind of from, in this issue, we talk about Elena's and her local sourcing. We talk about Jenny's ice cream and what she's done with her partnerships with Snowville Creamery. And then we talk to some of the local bars that are using edible ingredients from herbs to fresh fruit purees and making their cocktails. So if you have a variety of interests, you can find something in the magazine from the recipes to the pieces that are more thought-provoking to, you know, exciting things to do in our community around local food.
Okay, Tracy, we may have already addressed this a little, but I'd like to ask it just in the context of what Tricia's been saying. What's your advice generally to the people at the edible magazines in the preparation of those magazines? In other words, despite the local differences, what should be common to all of them?
Oh, what a great question. Well, obviously, you know, people really love our recipes. They tend to use great ingredients, and they're obviously in season when they're published. And a lot of people are doing a lot more home cooking. So recipes are definitely a common denominator. But people really, really love those stories about the hidden things in their community that might not be so obvious, whether it's a farmer, an ice cream maker, a cheesemaker. I think the most rewarding phone call we get at our office is and some of the local publishers tell me this too, that they'll call and say, I've lived here my entire life and I had no idea that this was happening in our community. And I think that's what's so rewarding about the work Tricia's doing and the others like her. They're we call it, diving into the hedges and ledges. You know, it's not everything that's going on right in front of our faces, but it's definitely finding those stories that have not been talked about before that are so exciting.
Okay. And you mentioned earlier the idea of networking. Is it just basically passing ideas back and forth between the diverse magazines? How does that process work?
You know, it's everything. It's passing ideas back and forth. We actually have an annual publishers conference every January where they all get together in the same room for 3.5 days, and we have think tanks and workshops and all of that. And it's also very social, as you can imagine. A community of like-minded people who publish these magazines are very social. They love food and wine and, you know, all the things. So it's celebratory. It's a big party and a big learning experience. So, I have to say, our publishers are one of the most collaborative and cooperative and supportive groups of people I've ever met. They teach each other how to be successful in business, and it's really a very special thing that happens every day.
We're going to take a short break, and we're going to be coming back in just a couple of minutes to talk more with Tracy Ryder and Tricia Wheeler about the local food movement here in Central Ohio and across America on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Ed Lentz.
Fresh Air film critic David Edelstein called the new movie Winter's Bone the best film of the year. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the director, Deborah Granick, and the author of the novel it's based on, Daniel Woodrell. And we hear from Marissa Tomei, who stars in the new movie Cyrus. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820, NPR News. Monday night at 9, WOSU-TV, History Detectives returns with its new season. In the premiere, detectives track a scrap of metallic mylar that could be one of America's early satellite balloons. And then they investigate the audacious notion that Andy Warhol's art may be on the moon. Explore these and other great mysteries as History Detectives. The History Detectives team of experts gives new and sometimes shocking insights into our national history. Watch History Detectives Monday night at 9 on WOSU-TV.
Support for WOSU comes from the law firm Isaac Brandt Ledman & Teeter, offering legal services to Central Ohio since 1936. Isaac Brandt Ledman & Teeter, big enough to win, small enough to care. On the web at isaacbrandt.com.
Sunshine today, a high of 85. Clear skies tonight, a low of 62. More sunshine tomorrow, and a high of 82. All Sides continues on WOSU.
We're back, talking more about the local food movement with Tracy Ryder from Edible Communities Incorporated and Tricia Wheeler, the publisher and chef for the magazine Edible Columbus, the second issue of which is on the streets even as we speak, I think, isn't it?
It is. It is. And it's going to be at more locations as we speak and throughout the week.
Okay. Within the local magazine, is there anything special that would be drawing our attention, something perhaps dealing with cooking, that kind of thing?
Sure. We are working through our edible cooking series, which has been so much fun to interact with our readers who have been joining us out at the MI Home Kitchen at Easton. We've been cooking up a storm out there, all sourcing everything we can locally and creating several different recipes an evening. And the cooking series is highlighted in the magazine, but some of the upcoming classes we have, we're actually going to be cooking tomorrow from the farms. We're doing four different dishes that will be purchased. The ingredients will be purchased tomorrow. We're doing later in the summer a vertical heirloom tomato tasting with two recipes, and then we're going to move on to cooking what Tracy had touched on, preserving the local harvest, pickling, canning, and preserving later in the summer.
So if people are interested in learning more about this series and getting involved with it, how would they go about it?
They can visit our Edible Columbus website or pick up a copy of our summer issue.
Okay. We have another call coming in. John, do you have a call, a question for us?
Yes, I do. My understanding is that certified organic involves not only avoiding spray, but also building up the soil with composting for, is it 3 years, I believe? Anyone know?
Yes, that's right, 3 years.
And more I'm coming to the conclusion that that really makes a difference in terms of the richness of the flavors and perhaps the mineral contents of the food. And while I haven't totally resolve the local versus organic issue in my head, and I kind of play the field and try to support local to some degree, I think there may be a role to play for people in demonstrating that there is a market for both local and organic, and I guess I'd just like to encourage any farmers that are kind of wavering to maybe take that next step and to go the certified route, or at least to do that soil improvement, whether or not they certify.
Okay, thanks for the thought. Any thoughts on that, Tricia?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something we're continuing to learn about and to make the connections between the soil, the richness of the soil, and what's going back into it after the harvest. And I'm learning as we speak about that. And Tracy, do you want to touch on some of the points about the soil?
Well, I recently myself have become aware of the fact that there are like worm scientists out there and soil builder scientists out there, and that, you know, this issue is obviously the basis for all of our good food, and it is incredibly important. And so, yes, I mean, I'm with John. As much as we can encourage farmers to do as much as they can to preserve topsoil and make it full of organic matter and more healthy, we're going to have healthier food, absolutely.
And let me just mention in passing on the earlier point that Tricia was talking about, the Edible Columbus magazine website has been linked to the All Sides webpage here at WOSU Public Media. You can get to that by going to wosu.org/allsides, and you'll find a link to the Edible Columbus website. Let's talk a little bit about farmers markets, where they fit into this entire picture. We've mentioned them a couple times along the way, but we haven't really zeroed in on the farmers markets. That's really a relatively new movement. I mean, there have been farm markets out there for the last 2,000 years probably. But in this country, it's sort of the modern farmers market movement in downtown areas is a relatively new sort of thing. Tracy, how do you see that fitting in across the country? And then we'll come in and talk with Tricia a little bit about here in Columbus as well.
Great. Well, we at Edible Communities, we love to say that we build urban-rural bridges, and partly because most of the farmers we write about are in the rural areas, but a lot of the buyers and people who want this kind of food are in the urban areas. So obviously, farmers markets are the vehicle in which those bridges are founded on. And the other thing it does is it allows the farmer to get rid of the middleman. They always say the great quote about farming is it's the only business where you buy retail and sell wholesale. And so farmers are always up against that cost issue where they have to buy all their seed, raise all their food, water it, and then sell it at wholesale. So farmers markets are one way to allow farmers to connect directly to the consumer and charge them a fair going rate for the food that they're creating. And, you know, I don't know the exact number, but I want to say it's something like in 1990 there were 500 farmers markets in the U.S., and now there are 5,000. So I know there are over 5,000 today, but so that's how big this movement really is and how enthusiastic shoppers really are about their farmers market.
Is that your experience as well here in Central Ohio? Trey?
Yes, absolutely. And just to touch on what Tracy said is I think they also bring such a sense of community. I enjoy so much waking up on a Saturday and walking through and not only connecting with the people that are growing and producing our food, but also with other neighbors or friends or like-minded people that are also strolling through our little neighborhood farmers markets. And they're not so little anymore. You have to get there early. I used to get my choice at 10 a.m. a couple years ago, and now I'm definitely there by 8 a.m. trying to source all the things I'm planning for the week. But another point, too, is that they're growing in our city. This year, we've added the one on OSU's campus. So now you can go on, I believe it's Wednesday evenings at the Wexner Center, and they have a thriving market that's just started up there. So there's new ones popping up all the time, and we have a complete listing on our website at ediblecolumbus.com.
One other thing that still exists in many major urban areas are public markets. There was a time when Columbus had four of them on virtually every side of the city, including the middle of downtown Columbus. Most of them are gone. Columbus has only one left, the North Market. I wanted to ask both Tracy and Tricia. Let's start with Tricia. Is the North Market part of this whole local foods movement as well?
Absolutely. I mean, they've been a big supporter of Edible Columbus from the day one. I think they were the first meeting I had when I was bringing the magazine to the city. And their support and buy-in from that very early stage was really, really a great thing for us. And they had known about the brand, so they were really excited it was coming to the city. But what the North Market has achieved is, again, a wonderful sense of community. When you walk through those aisles, it can interact, and you just there's exciting, dynamic things going on. And then when they add their farmers market out front on Saturday mornings, it's just a really special place to spend some time.
Tracy, do you have any thoughts on how public markets have responded to the local foods movement? Just generally?
You know, I think all markets are responding. I mean, this is something that's really become the forefront of, you know, everyday life, not just the fringes of a movement. So I think to the best of their ability, wherever possible, I mean, markets are just responding and trying to source, you know, as much as they can from their regional food sheds, definitely.
What's been the impact on the supermarkets of this movement, in your view?
Well, I'm not sure that it's necessarily impacted them one way or another. I know what they are trying to do is many of them are getting very, very good at using the language of the local foods movement to you know, make it look like they source more things locally than they do. I can give you an example, and I'm not trying to make them bad guys at all. I think everybody's trying to do their best. But here's an example. We were in a market somewhere where they had fresh cherries with signs all over the produce section saying fresh local cherries. And I knew that this area at that time of year in particular and almost never in the rest of the time of year grew cherries. And we asked, well, wow, local cherries, where did you get them? And it was from about four states away. And I asked the produce manager, well, what do you consider a local food? And he said, well, anything grown in the U.S. So I think the definition of what we consider local being something within a day's drive and what, you know, some of the boundaries to which other people can expand that definition are just different. But, you know, I think it's all good that people are paying attention and they're trying to make better choices.
Okay. We have another call coming in. Andrew, do you have a question or a thought for either Tracy or Tricia?
Yeah, I try to eat local food as much as possible, and I wondered if there's any way that someone could tour these local farms or maybe take a field trip or I suggested this to the people at the North Market Poultry Place, and they're so busy, they laughed at me like they couldn't plan that. But I would love to go to some of these farms that are local and just tour and learn and really, from that, encourage other people to eat local.
Tricia?
Yeah, Andrew, I'm excited to tell you, you can go to OFA's website, and there's a whole series of farm tours throughout the summer.
Wow, okay.
And so there's really fun, interesting events going on, and I think it would be exactly what you're looking for. And also, there's a company that I know about that's just forming, and she's going to be offering local food tours, personal local food tours to unique places and restaurants, and working with the markets, the chefs, and other unique gems in our community, and giving local food tours. So
okay.
Stay tuned for that. We'll have more information on our website in the coming months.
All right. Well, thanks a lot.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
Tracy, again, what parts of the country has the local food movement been most successful, and why would you think that's been the case in the past few years?
That's a really good question. Well, obviously, there have always been leaders in the local food movement before, you know, it became a movement, which, you know, obviously, California, where I have to say I spent half my life, but I got very spoiled there because, you know, seasonality is in all the time, so it's kind of a playground for local food, and because of the work Alice Waters did in the Bay Area with Chez Panisse. So obviously California was an early player, as was actually the state of Vermont. Vermont's very progressive in the local food movement. We have seen an enormous resurgence of traditional foodways and food stores and local food stories coming out of the South, which has always had a very long history of food traditions, as in the Midwest as well. I think a lot of folks in the Midwest are really paying attention to this now. And, you know, instead of all the corn and soybeans and all that kind of stuff going on, they're really bringing local markets back. Portland, Oregon is, I think, one of the most progressive cities in the U.S. right now. They have a farmers market on the university campus in downtown Portland that just fills like 6 or 8 city blocks. And it's almost year-round now, even though they don't quite have the seasonality of California. So, I mean, there's almost no area that's not really coming alive and doing something.
I was intrigued with the cooking series that Tricia was talking about. Tracy, do you have some other examples of some of these kinds of outreach educational programs that other edible communities are doing out there, similar to this sort of thing?
Yeah, you know, they're everywhere. I mean, there's everything from, you know, pumpkin fields and corn mazes and things going on in the summer and the fall. I'm trying to think of a good, you know, if you go to like a localharvest.org, for example, it's a national database of all kinds of family farms and farm programs. And there's a WOOF program, W-O-O-F, which is an internship program for young people who want to intern at various farms all around the country. They work on the farm in exchange for room and board and usually a small stipend. I mean, there's just all kinds of, you know, agritourism now where farms, a lot of wineries have people come to visit and stay, and they actually can do some farm chores if they want to while they're there. But, you know, I encourage people to just go online and look around, especially through sites like Local Harvest. There's just so much happening everywhere. If you're planning a vacation and you want to include, you know, a tour of a farm, there's always a way to do it.
Tricia, let me just ask you in passing,
sure.
What has been the reach of Edible Columbus geographically? When we say Edible Columbus, we think of the city of Columbus. Have you branched out into central Ohio beyond just the city limits of Columbus with regard to the magazine?
Do you mean with
availability?
Within availability?
I suppose availabilities, or just from what you're finding from subscribers as well as.
We have subscribers from all over the state, and some that have moved away from Ohio and are living out of state and are subscribing, which is really nice.
Yeah.
A lot of people sending gifts to parents or other people that used to live in central Ohio. In terms of the reach where we distribute, it's an interesting model. We don't distribute just like another complimentary magazine all over the city, but we distribute within advertiser locations. So we're supporting the businesses that are supporting us. And also our reach of stories, we are concentrating on central Ohio, but we will look all over Ohio for interesting things that are happening, and we'll tell those stories in the magazine.
And once again, if people are interested in finding out where they can find the magazine, the best place is just to go to the website.
Exactly.
Correct?
Yep.
Oh, okay. That sounds good. Let's see. So in your experience between the first and the second issues, what have you learned most about the way the magazine has to adjust, I suppose, to its market? I'm talking to Tricia now.
You know, what I've learned is that I would really love to publish more than four times a year because there's such an abundance of interesting things happening, and to have to edit down and pick and choose what we can feature in four magazines seems like a challenge. And also, I've been surprised at the talent of the writers and the photographers and the resources we have in our local community that have reached out and have offered to write for us or help or contribute ideas. It's really, you know, it's a magazine for the community, and we want the community to be involved and have a say in how we shape the future editorial and how the magazine looks and feels. And we were excited. This issue, we bumped up eight more pages because there was just so much to tell, and I didn't have the heart to cut anything. So,
Tracy, what's been your experience with the magazines as a whole? And have they evolved relatively quickly in their markets, or is it a more subtle process that you've seen?
You know, we really, really love sustainability in food and farming and in our magazines. So we encourage people to take their time and, you know, grow their magazine organically and make sure, like Tricia, you know, start the first issue a little smaller, add eight pages the next time and grow. It's interesting, though, Ed, because, you know, in the publishing world these days, we hear all the stories about, you know, Gourmet magazine closing its doors and how publishing doesn't do well. And what we've seen, even in this downturn economy for the last 2 years, is that we have a steady, consistent growth of something like 30% a quarter over, you know, all of our communities. And we're so proud of that, and we feel it's really remarkable. And clearly, you know, this publishing model of allowing these magazines to belong to the communities where they're published is really important to readers. And that's something we're just really thrilled about.
Okay. So if we had to summarize, Tricia, the most important of the local food organizations here in Central Ohio, we're talking the chefs and the farmers, of course, but basically as well, the markets, I suppose, is the...
Absolutely. And then there's been people in our community doing wonderful work, and we're just excited to come in and be able to be the storytellers of some of these different things that they've made really inroads in terms of local matters. I was so impressed with the Mid-Ohio Food Bank. I just recently did a tour of everything they've been able to accomplish there. I know that there's, you know, several organizations from OFA to the Farm Bureau, all looking at this issue and how they can support our community in terms of broadening awareness and education. So we're very lucky in Central Ohio to have people doing this kind of work.
As we close down, I'd like to just remember as well that Tracy Ryder and Carol Topalian have a nice book that's available in most bookstore outlets called Edible, A Celebration of Local Foods. And that's in addition to being able to find Edible Columbus, the magazine, at a number of outlets here around Central Ohio as well. We've been talking this morning with Tracy Ryder, who is the co-founder of Edible Communities, Inc., as well as Tricia Wheeler, the publisher and chef for Edible Columbus. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Ed Lentz, and we are listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks, Tracy. Thanks, Tricia.
Support for WOSU comes from The Other Paper, Columbus's news and entertainment weekly, on newsstands every Thursday and online at theotherpaper.com.